Hey everyone, this is 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. This episode, I'm joined by former NHL goaltender, two-time Vezina finalist, two-time All-Star, Mr. Kirk McLean. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe and rate in iTunes, Spotify, and all the streaming channels. As always, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at MikeMcKenna56. Football may not be over, but the NBA, college basketball, NHL, all in full swing. And the only place you should be betting on these sports is at betonline.ag. Look for those mid-value picks. Dallas, the Raptors, college basketball, always a Mizzou fan. BetOnline even covers awards, TV shows, reality TV. So some of those things you're watching at night, you might as well put a bet on them. BetOnline has hundreds of props and real-time odds on almost anything you can imagine. And of course, 24-hour online casino. Always open, never closes. So head to the website, use your mobile device, sign up today. You'll receive 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's betonline.ag. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. And now sending it over to Mr. Kirk McLean. Well, let's flip it back to the beginning. I mean, Toronto kid, you know, you get to the OHL, spend a couple years there. Next thing you know, you're in pro. Why goaltender? What drew you to the position?
Well, I fell into the position. I started my hockey career as a skater, and my first year of really somewhat organized hockey was more of a hockey school, but it was a full year. It wasn't just a couple months or a month of a hockey school. So, we learned the skills of the game, obviously, and the rules, and then got into scrimmages, later in the season. But there was a goalie school that would come on after each of our sessions. And at that time in the mid 70s, early 70s, the face masks were starting to get the paint jobs. So all the wild paint jobs were starting to come in on some of the goaltenders. And, you know, I was a little intrigued by that. And of course I grew up a Bernie Parent, a Jacques Plante fan. And then the likes of Doug Favelle came in when he was traded for Bernie from Philadelphia, and he had some face masks. And then Mike Palmateer came in and he had some wild face masks. Greg Harrison, a plethora of goaltenders back in the 70s that came to the Leafs. So I just kind of was like, wanted to stick around with my dad and watch what was going on. And this particular instructor that had the school was kind of like a drill sergeant. So I was kind of attracted to it. I don't know why. He had the puck machine, which was a huge thing back then. He had the brush cut, and he was pretty demanding of his goaltenders. And, you know, I just kind of fell in love with the position there. But I went on to play house league hockey for my first year house league hockey as a skater. And then in my second year of house league hockey, halfway through the year, we need a goalie. For some reason, we need a goalie. So myself and another player put our hands up, and we split the half a season. And I actually had some pretty good success and made the house league all-star team, and I had fun with that and just kind of stuck with it from then on. So pretty much from, I guess it was the age of seven, I guess it was late 6-year-old, seven, early 7-year-old, where I just fell into it and had early success and enjoyed playing the position.
Next thing you know, you're playing for Oshawa in the OHL. Quick, right? That quick. Did it go by that fast though? I mean, did you know that the OHL was probably a likely route for you?
Yeah.
Was it a surprise?
It was a surprise when it happened, because at the time I didn't really get into AAA hockey, if you will, or travel team hockey until Pee Wee. You know, I played kind of a lower level AA hockey, if you will, in local areas in Toronto. I played at Asian Court Civitan, which was my, I started out at Scarborough Lions Hockey Academy. That's where I started out. And then went Agent Court Civitan House League. And then I went to the Scarborough Hockey Association, which was the SHA, and played for Agent Court Lions. And then I jumped to the double A MTHL double A for Don Valley Villagers for a year. And then the Don Mills Flyers came knocking on the door and Pee Wee. And that's when I, went from Pee Wee through to midget with pretty much the same team. We grew as a group in the MTHL AAA category, and had success in Pee Wee, Bantam, and in midget as far as championships. And then of course, when you're in midget and you start to hear all the rumblings from amateur scouts and the odd agents knocking on the door to see where you're at as far as that part of the game, and, And that's when it starts to get a little bit more serious. But yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. I always felt I was going to go the OHA route or the OHL route. It wasn't quite on the radar for most players to go the college route. I was recruited, but I always, you know, wanted to play in the Ontario Hockey League or the Ontario Hockey Association at the time, and then go from there.
You get a couple of years at Oshawa. You're drafted after your first year by the Devils. So right. Things are progressing along. When did pro really come on the radar for you? When did you think you actually had a chance at the NHL?
Well, I think when you're in junior hockey, and I must say, I'll take a few steps back. When I got drafted as an underage into junior, so at that time, as a 16-year-old, you had to be drafted in the first three rounds. So I was drafted in the third round, but I opted to stay back and play another year of midget, just for development reasons. And I thought, you know, that plus my parents and my midget coach and other people around the game thought it would be better for my development, because at that time, Paul Theriault, who was the coach, and Sherry Basson, who was the GM in Oshawa, Paul was very big on playing his veteran players, and his rookie players didn't get much ice time.
Especially goaltenders, I'm sure.
Especially the goaltenders. Peter Sidorkiewicz was the goaltender at the time. So he was the number one guy. And, you know, he was going to play the bulk of the games. I think it was Jeff Hogg that came in and backed Peter up the year I didn't go as an underage. And I think he only played 10 games. So, you know, the development side of it wasn't going to be there for me. And that happened. It happened kind of the next year. Peter came back as an overage. I got the bulk of the game. So, you know, I think I got in 20, 25 games or so. But then I get drafted, you know, on my draft year in 84 when I was 18. And you know, reality was starting to set in. Your boyhood dream was starting to take place. And, you know, I didn't know where I was going to get drafted. You know, there was rumors or to who. At the time, Frank Jay, bless his soul, was a pro scout for New Jersey, but an amateur scout, obviously, for Oshawa Generals as well, along with being a school teacher in Oshawa. So he saw me a lot. So there was a plethora of players that came out of the Oshawa organization that ended up in the New Jersey system, you know, Joe Sorella, John McClain, myself, a few other players that didn't have a long career in the National Hockey League. But yeah, so I was super excited. I can remember the draft. It was in Montreal. I attended. It was a lot of sitting around till I got picked in the sixth round. But nevertheless, you know, it was a great time. And my dad was there with me, along with my minor hockey coach, who became a good friend with the family. So, you know, it was a good time, not just for me, but for them as well.
Was it pretty wild to get your first NHL games right out of junior hockey without any minor league experience?
100%. You know, I remember getting that call after we got beat out in junior in the playoffs, and there still was a few games left in Jersey's season. They weren't going to make the playoffs, but I got called up, and you know, I met the team in Quebec. That's where they were. It was the last three games. It was against the Nordique on the road, and then back-to-back home and home against the Islanders. So I sat on the bench for the first game in Quebec, and then sat on the bench for the start of the game in Long Island. And about, I guess it would have been probably 6 minutes in, we're down 3-0. And I get a tap on the shoulder by Doug Carpenter, who was the coach at the time, and Alain Chevrier was the goaltender, who was a horse for the team back then. And in I go against the almighty New York Islanders, that were just at the tail end of their dynasty, and they still had every single player on that team. And I can remember going in there going, oh my God, here I am lining up against Mike Bossy, Clark Gillies, Dennis Potvin, Brian Trotcher. You go down the list. Billy Smith in the other end. And you know, they got four on me. We lost, I think, 7-something that night in 2.5 periods. They got four on me or so. And then I started the last game the next night back in New Jersey, fan appreciation night. you know, there were rumors that they were starting me because they wanted to get the first pick and yada, yada, yada. And, but I threw a little
fan appreciation night. Here comes the rookie goaltender.
Yeah. We ended up winning the game at the end of the day, 9-7. Going into the third period, we're up 5-3. We win 9-7. I'll take it. It was a W.
That's perfect. Man, we have like a really similar first NHL game for both of us. Like mine was in Long Island too. And I got tossed in midway through the second period. We were down 3-0 like that. And Rick Tocchet's looking down the bench to me and going, get in there. And I'm like, I guess this is it. You know, I never even played an exhibition game at that point.
No time to think.
No, it wasn't. And it went well. So you end up going to Maine the next year. One of my favorite places in my journey. Yeah. I played 3 years there and you were a horse. Yeah. I mean, your first year pro, you got to play 45 games, which that's not necessarily common. So was that really falling into the right scenario?
Well, it was. And we had a plethora of goaltenders. You know, there was myself, Craig Billington, Chris Terreri, Sean Burke, who was still at that time with the Olympic programming.
Yep.
We had Elaine Chevrier, who was kind of the sacrificial lamb, if you will, up in New Jersey, along with Chico Resch had just retired. Ron Lowe had just retired. But we had Hanu Kampuri. We had Carl Friesen, who you may know that, you know, backbone to the German national team from Manitoba. You know, we had Bob Sauve. There was a lot of goaltenders going on there. And that particular year, we kind of rotated the three of us, myself, Craig, and Chris, would get called up for a couple months each. And but just to get that taste of what was going on, but to get 40 games in, like you said, down in the minors, you know, they were on there to develop their goalies. That's what it was all about. And Tommy McVie being the coach, we had a veteran team for the most part. When I mean veteran, the guys that were down there, not, I guess, career minor leaguers, but still had a pretty good stint in the National Hockey League. And it was just a great experience. And you're right. Maine was an awesome place to play. I lived on Old Orchard Beach.
Oh, man.
You know, with most of the guys.
I did, too, for 2 years.
My roommate at the time was Dave Anderson. The youngest thing. Yeah, no, it was great. Best lobster in the world.
Oh, I ate more lobster. I ate a lifetime's worth while I was there. Is there anything about Tommy McVie that you remember that really stands out?
Well, just his character. And, you know, every time I see him now and he's scouting for Boston, you know, he just does basically the West Coast games now, mainly Vancouver. He sees every game there. You know, he was just a character guy. I mean, an awesome person and a coach that you really wanted to go to bat for. He was old school without a doubt. I mean, you work hard and you play hard and you follow his system, and he was all for it. We had a playbook. You'd have a playbook made up every year for every single player. And then he would pull pop quizzes and surprise meetings, and you'd have to have that playbook everywhere with you, whether you're on the road or if you're at home. And you didn't necessarily have to learn it front to back, but you had to know what was going on as far as, you know, breakouts and penalty kill and all that stuff.
Yeah, so for a goaltender, maybe what's an example of something that he had in the playbook that was specific to our position?
Not nothing really. It was maybe the penalty kill, being involved with the penalty kill, but he certainly would do certain drills for the goaltender, because there was no goalie instruction down there at the time. And he would have, you know, us laying on our sides and guys would come down off the wing and rip the shot off the wing just that, you know, have you not get afraid of the puck, but he'd involve you in all the off ice stuff and the circuit training and everything. I love the guy. I love him to this day. And he certainly, you know, kept it interesting. His kids were named after all the cities that he coached in or played in. You know, he obviously had a stint in the National Hockey League as a head coach, but, you know, he's an awesome human being and he's a character guy. And he knows character people. That's for sure.
So many horses in the stable in Jersey, Billington, Burke, Terreri, yourself. Were you surprised to head to Vancouver?
No, I mean, Sean came up that 1 year we were down in the Mar. He came in from, if you're old enough, but he came in and played in the playoffs and played very well.
Yep.
Got them, you know, fairly deep into the playoffs. And And, you know, you knew that, you know, he was definitely going to be on the radar. And prior to that, Craig Billington actually went up as an 18-year because he was drafted in the second round and played a whole year. Yeah. up in New Jersey, and they got sent back down to Belleville. And then Chris, being Lou Lamorella's godson, Lou came
T-Bone's
in.
T-Bone's on the payroll forever, man.
Yeah.
I'll never get him to do an interview until he retires.
when Lou came in after Max McNabb retired, and Lou being me and Greg Adams being Lou's first trade, I'd never met the man. And, you know, he just called me in the first day of training camp and told me I'd been traded and to Vancouver, didn't tell me for who or who with, just the fact that the trade hadn't gone through the whole faxing part of it to the league. So he couldn't disclose everything. So I found out that it was Greg Adams when I was sitting on the plane, and then he boarded it in a little bit after than me.
So what were your expectations going to Vancouver?
I knew nothing about Vancouver, because any traveling that I did with in the NHL was all in the East Coast. As far as I got to the West Coast was the Max Midget Tournament in Calgary. 2 years I played there. Never got to Vancouver. All I knew about was my dad when he listened to the Leaf games on the radio at 10 o'clock at night. And that was it. You know, I vaguely remember the 82 series with them against the Islanders, but I was going in really green. Did not know what to expect. You know, landed there, and you know, Pat Quinn became the new GM. Brian Burke, the assistant GM. Burkey, I saw quite often because he was a Maine Mariner,
right.
and then went back to school and became a player agent. So he had a few clients on the team. So he was in town all the time. I'd see him all the time. And Bob McCammon, who was scouting at the time, had a place in Maine as well, where Steve Tajura lived. And we lived in the same complex right next door in an old Maine Mariner, Frank Baith, old yeah. Philadelphia Flyer. As
oh,
well.
I've golfed with Frank Baith before. He yeah. gave me so much shit over the pants I was wearing. He thought they were too tight.
Yeah. Bather, I mean, it's weird. I lived in his house, and he's an Oshawa family. He's from Oshawa originally. KG saw him all the time. He was a scout for he was scouting for Edmonton at the time, and it came full circle coming into Vancouver. And there's a story that goes behind it. I don't know if you've ever heard it.
Lay it on me.
So it's with Bob McCammon. So it's the last game of the season. And we play Fredericton our last game of the season. And at that time or that year, they decided they were going to bring a shoot in. They were going to bring the shootout in as a experimental to see if they were ever going to go to it in the National Hockey League at some point. And we ended up losing in a shootout the last game of the season to not make the playoffs. So that was a bummer. So we're out
in an experimental shootout.
Yeah, we're out that evening at Jay's Oyster Bar, which I'm sure you've been to.
I've had plenty of oysters there.
On
the water.
Having a good old time. The you know, the team, the whole team was out, Bob was there hanging out. He was at the bar, and if you know Bob McCammon at all, he can get pretty yappy and can get under your skin pretty quickly, you know, especially when you've had a few pops in you, and he's had a few pops in you. So he was, for some reason, he was on my ass, and I didn't know who he was at the time, but all the older players knew who he was. You know, they were aware of what was going on in the future. By the end of the night, I just had enough of his, you know, trying to get on my skin. And I just kind of went over there and started cursing at him and calling him names. You know, I basically said, bald-headed piece of shit, off, you know, get lost, leave us alone, we're just trying to have time here, right? And he's just laughing and smirking. The guys in the back, they're laughing and giggling because they know who he is and what he's like. And the night goes on, and I go back to the table. They go, you should be careful there, he could be your coach one day, you never know. And I'm going, what are you talking about? And then we just laughed it off. So make a long story short, get traded to Vancouver, land in Vancouver. I don't know what's going on. It's the middle of the night. We land, Greg Adams and I, we go right to the hotel because we got to meet the bus and head over to Duncan for training camp. as I'm walking on the bus, first person I say is Bob McCammon. I'm like taken back, going, what the hell is going on here? And I, you know, I just kind of put my head down because I try to, I finally figure it out and I try to walk by him without him noticing me. And he grabs me by the shoulder and he looks at me and he goes, looks like the bald headed fuck's got you by the balls now, doesn't it? So I just said, yeah, nodded and I just kept walking on. Yeah, no, that's how it all happened. So we got a good laugh out of that one.
Well, you're smiling about it. It seems like it turned into a good relationship.
It worked out. You know, he at the time there was Frank Caprice and Richard Berdur were still on the team. And Wendell Young, I believe, had just left for Pittsburgh, or they traded him to Pittsburgh in the summer. So we went with a three goalie system for the first part of the year. And then they ended up sending Frank down to the minors. And then at the trading deadline, traded Richard to Hartford and Weeks came in. So I ended up playing my first year, 42 games. So they played me a lot for my first year as well. And you know, obviously to get that call, from the coach and in the coach's office and say, listen, you're here to stay, go find a place. That was pretty nice. And that's what it was. Yeah, exactly.
What was your equipment like at this point in your career? You had the combo. You had the combo mask in New Jersey, helmet with the cage, and it started with brown colored equipment. By this time in 87, 88 in Vancouver, what had you switched in?
Well, Vancouver, I still had the combo, the Cooper helmet and the mask, and I had the brown pads, but they were experimenting with the suede leather. So they were the brown pads with the suede leather that I had and the brown gloves and brown belly pad and the one piece belly pad and arm protectors. That was pretty, not broken down, fairly new, but I was big into cutting my gear apart. I didn't like a big bulky stuff. I like to feel the puck and know where the puck was. And I basically just had caps on my shoulders.
Oh, I heard your arm and chest was an atrocity.
Yeah.
It was not a lot of protection on it.
No, I didn't like it. You know, I just, like I said, the feel of the, I knew where the rebounds were and, you know, and felt a little pain once in a while, but you know, I played the puck a lot too. So I felt better playing the puck and both my glove and blocker were pretty much nothing. I could pull them right out of the box and use at night, no problem. My glove was basically like a first baseman's glove. There wasn't much padding in the glove. It was good. Blocker was a blocker. I just changed the palm once a year, basically twice a year. I'd go through a glove once a month almost.
Were you in Vaughn at that point?
I was in Brown and then Vaughn gloves. Yes. I had Brown gloves at first and then Vaughn gloves, brown pads. And then I experimented with Miller pads and then got into the Vaughn pads after that. Yeah.
So what did you like in a pad? Like we talked gloves and arm and chest briefly, but what about a pad were you looking for?
I like something that could break in super quick. It took till, I guess, probably the end of my first year where Vaughn came in with kind of the K-POC of stuffing or foam stuffing, where it broke in really quickly and was super light compared to the Miller pads and the brown pads that were leather. And had either the horse hair or the deer hair in it, whatever.
Yeah.
And I just like the fact that I could pull it out of the box and wear it for a practice. And then when she was ready to go.
I think that was the Vaughn Legacy. That was like a big step forward, right? Had some foam in it. Like, did you do anything custom to them at all? Or were they a pretty stock pad other from
pretty, size? Pretty stock pad. You know, I wasn't big on doctoring it up at all. They knew what I liked right off the bat, just something nice and basic and just go with a traditional pad.
So why did you stick with a Nash blocker and Nash glove palm, that brown color?
Yeah.
There were people that kept the glove longer, but you kept it, I mean, to the bitter end.
Yeah. I think it just became who I was, I guess. I wasn't one for, you know, I did start, you know, my pad blocker or my blocker and glove, you know, other than the palms and the, obviously the top of the blocker with a Nash color, but they can, you know, put the coloring in the rest of the glove. And then the pads, I switched over when they switched the material over to something that was going to be a little bit lighter and better with the water, as far as not soaking in the water as much. So I was able to start putting color in my pads, obviously, and then I went simple again and just went black, basically, with some color on the trim. So I always got some bash because everybody goes, "Well, why didn't you go white? Because then you're disguising the net and blah." And I'm like, "Come on! I mean, players aren't that stupid when they're gonna, look up and go, 'Oh my God, there's white pads there. That looks like a five hole. I'm gonna shoot for that.'"
We're kindred spirits, man. I think same way.
I know. I can understand the hockey stick, the player with black tape as opposed to white tape that can disguise the puck. But as far as the white pads blending in with the boards, I don't go for that.
You know what I always thought was funny about white tape on a blade is that white tape could actually disguise the release of the puck because it blended in with the ice a little bit. So it kind of went both ways for me reading shots. Like the black I'd lose in the blade, whereas I couldn't read as well from a white.
Yeah.
It just really depended on how they did it. Isn't it funny now how into the equipment that goalies are when they're designing their colors and their setup always matches? And to me, like, you had one of the most iconic setups of your time frame. But really, it didn't even match by today's standards. And to me, that's what made it so awesome.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all about social media now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's all about the likes on the gram.
100%. I mean, you're seeing goalie their kits, their masks, their gloves, their pads before they even get them delivered. Somebody's taking a picture of them, and they're going through with all the different jerseys that they wear. They have a different setup for each jersey.
Yep.
Which blows me away. I mean, it goes to show you the way the game's changed there. There's no superstition going on, or there's no feeling comfortable in one set of gear. I mean, these guys are changing pads or gloves, every 5-10 games, maybe. It depends on what jerseys they're wearing. I could never do that.
No, it's
I
different.
Found it tough. A couple of All-Star games that I played in when I had to put shells over my pants to match the shirts, I found it tough.
Oh, doesn't it feel like we're wearing a diaper?
It does. I mean, it tightens everything up and it just don't feel the same.
I struggled when I got traded late in my career, I had to wear shells.
Yeah.
I couldn't move.
Me too.
I thought they were awful.
Yeah, me too. And it took a while to get used to all that kind of stuff. And it was, at the end, it was later in my career where things were evolving. I had to get used to a lot of things. And one was the change of my role. Less games, starting to lean towards the more of the backup role and taking more shots, practicing maybe a little bit longer and a little bit more. And, so I had to beef my gear up, I had to get used to now leaving the padding in and in practice, maybe putting two cups on, that type of thing, because I was taking way more shots.
So you touched on your puck handling earlier, and that's something I noticed about your career very early on. And it really hit home because I got a Hespeler stick that was your pattern. But the ironic part is that I catch with my right hand, right? So Hespeler was taking your pattern and just flipping it and selling that on the market. And I think it was pretty close to your pattern. And like, here's the thing, I'm so into sticks and equipment and all that, that I noticed that your stick, like, it had a little bit of bevel on the bottom and it had some curve to it. And it looked like you'd really messed around with it to find what you liked. Is that true?
It was like a 13 lie modified, like you said, the heel was rounded. So it was more like a player stick at the end of the day. So I could stick handle and make direct pass. It wasn't just all about shooting it off the glass. It was about making a pass.
Yep, still
that's what I call by a good puck handling goaltender. Not the fact that he could shoot it off the glass. And there's also a lot of goaltenders that people think they're really good at puck handling, but they overdo it, and they're actually not good at what they think they are. But I got my pattern based on Peter Sidorkowicz's stick, actually. As in Oshawa, if you were drafted, the trainers allowed you to get your own pattern.
It's a big deal.
And Cooper being the main sponsor back in the day, Cooper Rolls and all that kind of stuff, and the helmets and the gloves. In the league at that time, when I got drafted, I was allowed to get my own pattern, from Cooper. And I just basically took Peter's stick. I loved the way the lie was and the way he rounded his heel as well. I tweaked it a little bit at the toe, where I put just a little bit of an upshoot, just to give me a little bit of something at the toe, but it didn't have a huge curve on it. And because I like the backhand as well, I think that obviously very important, and not just using your forehand, and just lived with it from there. And I went into my first year as pro using Cooper, and then being in Vancouver, Louisville was a big pusher. So I started using Louisville, and then was introduced to the company International Stick that was out of Toronto and Europe somewhere, Montreal as well. And they just purchased Hespeler. So the loyal guy that I am, I moved to Hespeler and didn't do it for dough, just did it over friendship. And, you know, they may have fired me some grass cutting equipment or something like that, or golf clubs or whatever. And I had that, I had the exact same relationship with Vaughn. And then of course to Eagle when Ross moved to Eagle, I wore the equipment. I used a stick because I liked it, one, but because they were my friends, and you know, I wanted them to have success. You know, I'll scratch my back, and you know, and we had that relationship, and we have that relationship till today. Now guys won't use a stick for over $5,000. I'm well, the hell's $5,000 gonna do? By the end of the time you get that money, it's $2,000 or $2,500, because you know, the government's going to take half of that. You're getting nothing out of it. I'm more for taking merchandise, because one, you don't get taxed on it. Two, the company can write it off.
I never understood that. Like, you want to play with what you really like, yeah, in the first place, to
exactly.
me. Like,
exactly.
That 10, 15 grand to some of these guys that are making $4 or $5 million. Like, why are you bothering with that? Unless you're doing it for charitable cause or something like that. It's
exactly.
That's a little bit different.
You're getting, if you're into the six figures, you know, right, you're $100,000 plus something, maybe. But yeah, I never felt each year. But yes, if they're doing it for charitable, you know, more power to them.
So I saw a picture that the bottom of your skate in big bold letters said weird on it. Can you give me the background on that?
That became a joke with myself and Pat O'Neill and at the time Ed Georgica, who was his assistant trainer, and bless his soul, Larry Ashley, who was our head physio. You know, we would be calling each other all different names, weirdo, weirdest, you're the weirdo, whatever it may be. And then of course, when you leave the building, the trainers have whatever freedom to do whatever they want to do with your equipment. And Pat O'Neill wrote weird on the back of my, on the skate. And I went on a winning streak of, or a winning streak or no loss streak of like 12 games. So I just stuck with it. And every time I got a new pair of skates, or if he just put a new cowling on, that became tradition for him to put weird on it. And to this day, you know, I play forward now. I haven't played goal since the day I retired. I play forward or defense. You know, he'll still fiddle around with my player skates, and he'll put weird on the bottom of my player skates sometimes.
Amazing. You know, you had some interesting nicknames in your career. I mean, you show up and you're Captain Kirk. And I also heard Kirky Complain, and I'm hoping you can look back at these and laugh at them.
I do.
But like,
I still get them.
I mean, Captain Kirk, did you ever get to meet Shatner?
I never did. You know, that, you know, obviously came with that whole scenario, but never met Shatner. You know, Vancouver, you know, Richard Berdour was King Richard. You know, when Luongo came, Bobby Liu, you know, they're pretty good at naming the goaltenders. But you know, it's kind of cool. Kirk Complain is, I think, one that you know, even away from hockey, that's probably something that the guys like to call me and laugh about, because I can do that. I take that with a grain of salt, find myself, you know, bitching and moaning or complaining once in a while, but it's all for the good. It's all for the good.
You know, who told me that was Mark Parrish, and he was like a rookie at the time. He said he never ever called you Kirky Complain, but he heard Mellenby and some of the older guys calling you that, and it stuck with them all these years. So talking earlier about having the mask and the cage, like, how excited were you to finally get a Harrison mask? You already mentioned everybody in the 70s, Favell and down the list that had one.
Yeah.
Had to be a huge moment for you to finally get one made.
Oh, it was so cool. You know, to be able to go do that. And Harrison, I remember the day when we were in Toronto, and I go down early before practice to get all fiberglass and molded up with the, you know, you had the things up your nose and out your mouth, and for Greg to mold you up. And then at that time, I would make the journey back to Toronto in the summer times for the first couple of years, back to the Oshawa Whitby area. So I was able to go to his warehouse and see it being made. And, you know, poor Greg, and, you know, I stay in contact with him now, but he, you know, I don't think he really knew what he had going at the time. And he is such a perfectionist that a mask would take forever to get, because he was making a lot of people. And at the time before Lefebvre came along, and he was the only guy doing it. And, you know, he would take a long time, and it almost took the whole year to get that mask. And, you know, the last probably 10 games is when I got it. I was so excited. And we were wearing a yellow color as our home uni. So it was yellow.
Right.
The base was yellow. So it looked so cool. And just the nice, simple little with the Canuck skate logo up the top and the V and the V on the chin and on the back piece was the V at the time. You know, I felt like I had arrived again. Here I am, a professional goalie with a nice paint job and a hybrid mask, and it fits so good. And you know, he was such an innovator of the mask and you know, able to, you know, add deflectors and hone his craft. And he was always improving that mask from the 70s on, you know, or maybe even the late 60s when he probably started doing it. So yeah, it was pretty cool.
I love how he integrated your family's tartan into it, right? I mean, I'm
fellow
Scotch-Irish. Like, that's really cool. Yeah.
Same with me. Yeah. I mean, it was so cool. And I just let him do. I gave him kind of a concept and just let him do what he wanted to do. And he would do some extensive background checks on everything. It was my, you know, my full dress tartan that he had on the Vancouver for 4 years. And then when we changed the colors of the uniforms, when we went to the sea with the orca and the silver and everything, he did some more research, and he changed the tartan on the top and on the back piece. And then when I went into Florida, the same thing, he did a whole background with the colors there, the Florida colors, and then the same thing. So it was pretty, you know, I just loved his work. I love his, you know, his stories that he tells on Instagram.
Pretty
now,
cool.
if you follow him, you know, every goaltender, yeah, every goaltender's birthday, he tells the story of the mask and has all those pictures. It's pretty cool the way he explains his designs and what he wanted to represent.
Whole lot more with Kirk McLean to come. First, I want to tell you about the online goalie coaching that I'm doing with 44visionhockey.com. If you go to that website, 44visionhockey.com, you can choose your coach. Well, put me in. I would love to work with you. What we end up doing is taking your games either through Live Barn or Hockey TV. We upload them, get all the clips. Then we have a Zoom meeting. Go through everything, see what's working in your game, what could be improved. And we just discuss it and go through all of those things. And it's through the eyes of a pro. It's what I've seen. It's what I've learned from all the goalie coaches that I've had. My knowledge of the game, taking it to yours. So it's super simple to do. Sign up. Get your clips in. We have our review session. You get clips uploaded to your own personal page. You can always look back on those, kind of like a Cliff's Notes. And then once again, go into our Zoom meeting, go over everything, and keep the dialogue going. You get access to myself, my knowledge, all that stuff. So 44visionhockey.com, love to work with you. And now a whole lot more from Kirk McLean. I think one of the reasons why your career was really on the radar for myself as a kid is because St. Louis and Vancouver were always tied in trades, it seemed like, you know, and the trade that sent Ron and Courtnell from Meso Dirt to you guys, and the Blues got Dan Quinn and Garth Butcher back. And like, Garth Butcher was a great defenseman. Dan Quinn didn't really pick it up in St. Louis, but like, that seemed like a big turning point for your team in Vancouver that led to the success.
Well, it was a huge turning point, and, you know, Cliffy was involved in that. I mean, it was tough because Garth was such a good friend. Right. To this day is still a good friend. He was kind of a mentor, him and Doug Litster, who ironically ended up getting traded as well. Garth, Doug Litster and Craig Cox, believe it or not, we were the kind of the fearsome foursome. They were the guys that kind of took me under their wing and and showed me the ropes, which if you know them all, and it was fantastic. Garth especially. I mean, Garth was a they're all, you know, good hockey players, you know. I don't think Coxie got the credit for how talented he actually was. Yeah. You know, we all obviously knew how tough he was, but
Garth was a big voice in the room though, eh?
100%. Yeah. So was Doug. Doug was as well. You know, they were both assistant captains on the team, and you know, Butchie was a first round draft pick. You know, could play a mean
tough
game.
Tough as nails.
Tough as nails, but also had good hockey sense and could rack up some good points. And Doug, the same thing. You know, Doug wasn't, you know, maybe the one that would drop the gloves very often, but he could still play very physical, and he was a big guy and obviously a student of the game, and could rack up a few points as well. Where Coxie, you know, he kept it fun in the locker room. That's for sure.
Can't have enough of those guys.
But he had silky hands. He had silky hands, and those guys. And that day, especially, never really got the credit.
You guys were building towards that Stanley Cup run in 94, you know, like,
yeah,
Lyndon comes in, like there's momentum with the organization. And then first round against Calgary, the save you are credited with the save in Vancouver history. I mean, two pad stack in overtime. Did you guys know something special was happening at that point?
We kind of had something. Felt something was going on. You know, we had good teams for 2-3 years at least, leading up to that year, you know, building up to that, where we thought, you know, we were better teams than what we achieved in the playoffs. We for myself out, excuse me, in the playoffs, you know, we battled for the President's Trophy on a couple of years in the early 90s leading up into 94. We had a good little run there. Even though we lost in Game 7 to Calgary in 89, I kicked in Joel Otto's kicked in goal. I'll still stick with it. you know, we played extremely well with the club there. Pat started making some changes and building towards the 94 team. But we had better teams than what we showed in the playoffs. You know, leading up to 94, we backed into the playoffs basically in 94. I think we didn't solidify a playoff spot until maybe 4 to 6 games left in the season.
Hey, you guys were number 7 seed.
Yeah. So we had to, you know, fight our way in. And then, you know, we played Calgary first round. They were number 1 seed, I believe, in the league. They were one of the favorites to win it. We go into Calgary the first game, we win. So we're up 1-0. And of course that year was the year they were going, I think it was the choice of the top seed, whether they wanted to play the first 3 games at home or the second 3 games in the road. And they opted to play 3 games on the road. So we played the first 2 games there, split, come home. And then they win the next 2 games to go up 3-1. And then we pick our way back to get to game 7 in Calgary. And the rest is history, as you know. The save happens.
Yeah, walk me through it. Give me some analysis on it. I want to know from your perspective facing that 3-on-1 what you saw and how you made that save.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that led up to it. There was probably 2 or 3 saves before that that were just as big, and one being in regulation late in the third period. After, if he doesn't score, Greg Adams with 3 minutes left, we would get into overtime. But Al MacInnis had a pretty good chance with about a couple minutes left where he walked into one at the top of the circles, and I was able to get my cheater of my glove on it to make a, you know, obviously a good save under the circumstances. And then, you know, we get into the overtimes, and it's a seesaw, you know, tactical game going back and forth, you know, basically exchanging blows. Vernie was making some saves at one end. I was making some saves at the other. And then we go into late into that period, and the 3-on-1 happens where Dana had pinched, and you know, his partner, longtime partner at the time, was Yerky, and Yerky played it great. You know, he stayed in the middle. I was probably yelling at him, you know, just stay in the middle. Don't commit. He did commit, you know, at the last minute. So, you know, and at the corner of my eye, I saw Jeff Courtnell busting his rear end to get back, which surprised me more than anything because that rarely happened.
He was inspired.
He was inspired. So I, you know, out of desperation, and with Theo carrying the puck, had all different options. He'd scored on me earlier in the second period, coming the same play almost, where he came down and shot it and beat me tweeners.
So you had to honor the shot.
Absolutely. And him being as nifty as he is, he could have shot it. He could have held up and come across himself or on around the net and tried to, you know, wrap around or many options, you know, the talented player that he was. And, you know, Jurki, you know, decided to kind of do an angle, slide across and force that pass. And I was able to read it and anticipate it and time it to a T where it landed on Reichel's stick and my pads landed at the same time. And, you know, he really wasn't able to get it up as quick as he could. And I was able to get my pad there at the exact same time where the puck met his stick and then just, you know, with the bottom leg, kick it out. But growing up as a kid, we learned that move. That was part of our arsenal, was the two pad slide. And you know, when we were doing drills or we were teaching drills, that was something we taught.
Yep.
You know, it was a desperation move because you were, you know, you're taught to play the angle, play the shooter, and to get across, that was how you got across as quick as you could. It was to throw your legs out and slide across, and it worked in that particular moment. And then we get through that first overtime, and then boom. Early in the second overtime, Jeff Brown, out of the corner of his eye, I still watched that highlight, was able to spot Pavel breaking down the middle, and he just threaded the needle with just an unbelievable pass with Pavel in stride. And I think he, you know, there's no doubt Pavel caught Vernie flat-footed.
Yeah.
Because Pavel was going 100 miles an hour, and I don't think Vernie expected a breakaway to happen like that. And Pavel basically just skated it into the net after he just made one move on Bernie.
Had anybody in the league seen anything like Pavel Bure when he showed up, the speed that he played with?
I don't think so. I think some of the older guys were maybe used to somebody like a Mike Gartner and maybe had that speed, or obviously Guy Lafleur. Those were the guys that come to mind. But, you know, Pavel brought it to a different notch where he was electrifying. And what he was able to do at high speeds with his hands and in tight was amazing. I mean, you're seeing it again at another level with Connor McDavid now.
Right.
You know, it blows me away what Connor McDavid can do at the speed and how quick his hands and what he can do in tight. Mind you, he doesn't have guys hacking him with two-handers and, you know, trying to take his knees out like Pavel did, and which ultimately ended his career. You know, he took a beating. Because one, he loved to score, and he did whatever it took to score a goal. And he there was nobody that went harder to the net, I think, than Pavel Bure. He would, the way he cut to the net and get hacked down and cross checked. You know, I'd like to see some of the superstars of today play in our era where they had to take a beating to score a goal. Not saying they don't have to work for it now, but. Gosh, guys are scoring, you know, 50 goals plus by taking two handers across the hand. Maybe the goaltending wasn't as good as it is now. Maybe, you know, on the most part, but still, you know, to be able to take a beating like they did and score goals, dry hand coordination while they're getting cross checked and slashed and goaltenders hacking them across the ankles or giving them the little flip between the legs, you know, tough sledding, but they did it. And, you know, I'm not saying that the guys now are it's amazing to watch without a doubt. They're incredible athletes and talented human beings. And the game is so fast. It blows me away sometimes.
I got a taste of it in junior, you know, my junior was 99 to 2001 and it was still pretty tough then. And, you know, I'm 16 years old, 18 to 20 year old men. I mean, North American League back then, you didn't even have to wear a face shield or a half shield. If once you turned 18, it had that flavor. And I'm glad that I have the perspective of playing in that tough of hockey, especially nowadays for what I'm doing, to be able to relate to what you're talking about. You guys upset three teams on your way to the Stanley Cup Finals. Again, a 7 seed and a lot of OT games. And you and I know as a goalie, the more you win those OT games, the more confidence your team builds. You start to feel like you're unbeatable, and you end up going seven games. But the first game of the Stanley Cup Finals against the New York Rangers, one of the best goaltending performances I've ever seen, a lot of people have ever witnessed. I mean, was that the best game that you ever played? 52 saves, 3-2 overtime victory.
I get that asked. I get asked that a lot. I think it's 1A and 1B. I played one game. It's definitely there. Yes. I mean,
and on the big stage
game one of the Stanley Cup Finals in New York, a 52 shot performance and to win it in overtime. It's definitely there, without a doubt. But there was one game that I played in early 90s. We were in, I don't know if you've been told this, but we were in Montreal, the old Forum, and I hated playing. We only saw them twice a year, maybe three times a year, the scheduling at that time. And for some reason I had lousy success in the old Forum and Maple Leaf Gardens, but we were in the old Forum and they had a pretty good team at the time. They just come off a cup, you know, Patrick's in the net. They had Charbonneau, they had Kirk Muller, they had Corson, and they had a good team. And we shut them out 3-0. I get a 3-0 shutout in the Forum with a 50 some odd shot, score. So I put that right up there. First star in the Forum, standing ovation. Chills. I still get chills down my spine thinking it was an unbelievable feeling. And, you know, I grew up hating the Montreal Canadiens because I was a Leaf fan. Right. But I totally appreciate, you know, the fans and the sports and the history and you know, what that city means to hockey and what that province means to hockey. And to get that standing ovation was a thrill, one of the thrills of my life. And I will never forget that moment. And I have to thank the, you know, obviously the Montreal fans for their appreciation.
Despite you guys losing out in game seven, do you still look back at that run though as being pinnacle of your career, the highlight of it?
Totally. Totally. Without a doubt. I mean, it hurts, you know, as a lot of us don't, we don't go back and watch it. I see it once in a while on, you know, flashback games on ESPN or TSN or whatever what's going on, but I don't sit and watch it for any length. I just kind of watch little bits because I'm my worst critic, right?
I know. I hate watching
goals going in on me. What could I have done? And I wasn't a big video guy. You know, I didn't like to go back and watch a lot of video. I knew what I did wrong. And I just knew mentally what it was. And I just wanted to forget about it and get on. And I'm not for one to, I hate watching myself make saves too, because I'm just that guy. I just play the game and, you know, it's my job to make the save. And, you know, if it goes in, that's behind me. I want to concentrate what's going on, but every now and then a glimpse of it on a monitors, or if you're flipping the channels, it's on there, and it's tough to watch, but totally the pinnacle of my career. It was an amazing run. I can't take that away from us. We did come up short. We didn't reach our ultimate goal. We failed. But you know, to this day, people coming up and they talk about what it meant to them and, you know, where they were at the time, you know, they stopped their wedding to watch the games and they did this, or their kids were born and they've named their kids after players on the teams or their animals. And for some reason, the 94 team has plays a big part in the people of Vancouver. And it's incredible. Like they had the 82 team. That was a great bunch of guys and a working class team that worked their tail off to get to that point. And then of course the talented, wonderful team they had in 2011, where they should have won it. We all thought they were going to win it for sure. But for some, everybody gravitates to that 94 team. It's an amazing feeling. And what can I say? We hold a certain piece in everybody's heart here, as they do in our hearts. And it's nice walking around town and feeling like the people are your friends, and you can sit down and shoot the breeze no matter who it is. It could be on the park bench, or it could be in the pub or the coffee shop, and it's just they're like one of the guys, and there's no celebrityism where you're trying to hide from them or pull your hat down or any of that kind of stuff. It's just It's like they've always been there beside you all the time.
Do you think that's why there was such a visceral response to the 50th anniversary celebration when you skated out in the replica gear?
You know, maybe. I think, obviously, I'm still in Vancouver, but you got Courtnell's in Vancouver. You got Cliffy here, Gino, Trevor, obviously. You know, guys that played before that, Gary Volk. Sergio Amasso comes in and out because of his gig that he has with the Canadians, and you know, Stan Schmil is still here, obviously, and we see these people all the time, and it's like we just pick up from 94. It's awesome, and I know I'm blessed with my position and what I do for the Canucks, and you know, my little role when with Rogers that I do with hometown hockey, I get a chance to go to all the stops in BC and represent Rogers and the Canucks at these small towns that I don't necessarily get to go to all the time. We try to get there with our alumni to play charity games, but just doesn't happen all the time. So it's amazing. I just love it. And the people are so awesome, and I couldn't be more blessed. I really, really enjoy it. There's not the fact that it's a beautiful, beautiful province. And you know, I somewhat grew up here. I got traded here at the age of 20, 21 years old. And, you know, I go back to Ontario and Toronto maybe once a year for 4 days or so. And that's enough for me. I get out of Dodge. I got to get back to Vancouver.
When I saw you skate out wearing that gear and just knowing you hadn't played goalie or put that on in so long, like, I was hyperventilating. I'm like, this is my childhood coming to life on the ice again. And I was working for Vegas at this point, and I remember seeing it and just going, I can't believe my eyes. But there was a really cool backstory to it. There's a fireman in the area named Josh Bowman that you actually had to lend you the gear, right? What was the full story on that?
They found his gear through Facebook or something, the trainers, and he had this replica set of mine almost right to the T. The pads were, you know, a little bit, I had 34 inch pads. These were probably up around the 36ers. So they're a little bit, a little bit taller, but they look good. The gloves were, you know, obviously modern day gloves, but they look like mine. I had my old mask that I'd used. The only thing that was mine was my mask and my stick, which Pat O'Neill, the head equipment guy for the Canucks, had packed away somewhere back in the locker rooms somewhere where I'd signed either for him or somebody that he was going to give it to. So he pulled it out of the archives. I was afraid to lean on it. It'd probably break because it was probably so brittle. And he did the same thing for Stan Schmil. He pulled Stan's old Sherwood stick that he'd signed. It was on the blade. You could see them both on the blade, but you couldn't see it on TV. So those were the only two things. I had Dan Cloutier's old skates that he had when he was the goalie coach there that I was wearing. I hadn't skated on goalie skates in 20 years and different type of skate. And the night, it's two nights in a row, especially, you know, I was out, I went late at night down to the rink to skate around on goalie skates, to get used to skating on goalie
Take
skates.
A couple hot laps.
I did. I was out there for about a good half an hour to 45 minutes twirling around.
So you were nervous about the
backwards.
Skate.
Absolutely. I didn't want to fall on my ass. And then the night before, I went back and actually put the pads on, to skate with the pads on, to be able to have that feel of skating and balance with the pads on, because I didn't want to step on that ice, even though it was only to the blue line. It seemed like an eternity there for, you know, when the lights are dimmed and you're going out to that blue line.
When you look back on your career, as much time as you spent in the NHL, the success, like, is there anything more gratifying than being inducted into the Ring of Honor for the Canucks?
Yeah, that was a special evening. And, to be the second one, Orlan Kurtenbach was the first, and then to be the second one to be put up there on that ring was pretty special. I was, you know, kind of surprised and taken back when Mike Gillis gave me the call and let me know that I was going to be the second one behind Orlan. And just for the fact of him to get that started and to form a committee ring was, you know, a testament to him. I mean, I think that's, you know, although we haven't won the Stanley Cup here in Vancouver, you know, we've been to the dance three times, and, you know, there's still some history, some great history here, you know, even leading back to the Western Hockey League before the NHL, and of course, way back to the Millionaires. But it's nice to have that tradition and to bring that, you know, you don't have to necessarily win a Stanley Cup to have that tradition. And it was quite an honor. And you know, it's carried on. I got inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. You know, being an Ontario boy to be able to be, you know, inducted into the BC Hockey Hall of Fame was a great thrill. And then last year, you know, being inducted into the BC Sports Hall of Fame, we were unable to do the ceremony because of COVID. So I think we may do a double with if we can do it this upcoming summer. But to get that call as well, it's just been just a good ending to retirement. To have these accolades at the end of my hockey career and to be able to be appreciated and acknowledged, not just from the Vancouver fans, but the media and the people in the sports community in general. It's just awesome.
Awesome indeed. Big thanks to Kirk McLean for hanging out a little bit, telling his story. Pretty amazing stuff in there. Toronto kid going to Vancouver, making good on it, carving out a life. If you enjoy 6 Degrees, please subscribe and rate in iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're interested in advertising on 6 Degrees, contact Believe at BLEAV.com. And you know you can always find me on social media at Mike McKenna 56. Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna.